I'm talking today with Dr. Bastian Zeidel, who is the new president of the Royal Australian College of GPs. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Nope. It's been a busy few weeks.
Yes, I can't complain. It's been very busy indeed. I spent more time in the Qantas lounge than at home. That comes with the territory, really.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. It's been a busy few weeks because there's been a lot of issues popping up. The last couple of days have been about the obesity policy.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the college's role in formulating that and what you see going forward.
Yeah, certainly. As you know, the Committee of Medical Presidents or Presidents of Medical Colleges had a position statement published fairly recently, and we did hold the Obesity Summit here at College House with the RACGP. And it's really clear that we need to tackle the obesity epidemic in Australia head on. We are spending over $8 billion every year on obesity-related medical issues, a fair bit. We know that 26% of Australians are considered to be obese as well, which is quite a problem. So just to tell our patients, off you go and lose some weight, it's not going to be good enough anymore. It has to be a comprehensive approach that allows patients to lose weight, and even more important, to prevent patients from gaining weight. So, you know, that's one of the things we actually, you know, talked about just, you know, yesterday and the day before.
Yeah. The fact that the emphasis is shifting from losing weight to not gaining it in the first place is a pretty significant shift, isn't it, for policymakers?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, how do we prevent obesity? You know, that's really the question. So we increasingly know there are genetic factors there as well. But again, you know, it's part of your risk profile then again needs to be tackled. So we've got to talk about healthy food choices. We've got to talk about having the infrastructure there that allows people and our patients to exercise on a regular basis. It should become the norm rather than the exception. That's quite a few things we need to address.
What about the sugar tax? That's also been in the headlines.
Yeah, sugar tax has been discussed for obvious reasons. As you know, there are, you know, a few natural experiments, for example, in Mexico and in Denmark and so forth. Again, you know, the evidence is inconclusive at this stage. And the question often is whether the effects we see immediately after sugar tax has been introduced are actually sustained. That means, you know, the sugar tax needs to be passed on to consumers rather than being absorbed by retailers.
Yes.
So again, it's not as simple as we think it could be. But again, it's worthwhile considering in order, again, to tackle the obesity epidemic we are truly facing.
One of the other issues that's been floating around in the last few weeks is the healthcare homes trial. I think we talked to you last week for a story about the funding of the trial. What's the college's view? Is the trial being given a fair chance in terms of the funding it's getting?
So we are concerned, you know, that the trial is being funded to fail. And we need to have a look at what we actually want to achieve by introducing a healthcare home or by introducing and promoting what the RACGP calls the medical home. So the medical home was, you know, floated in a position paper that the RACGP published in September 2015. And what the medical home ensures is comprehensive care in a primary care environment, in your general practice. And if we improve that, we are saving a lot of money that is currently being wasted in the tertiary care system, hospitals.
Yeah. Yep.
So unnecessary hospital admissions, unnecessary outpatient department presentations, you know, duplication of tests and so forth as well. So the idea really is we need to set up the medical home in order to shift excess costs from the tertiary care setting and make that as funding for general practice. And there's plenty of evidence to support it. If we have a look at the details of the healthcare home trials, the way it's being proposed, you don't see anything like that at all. So it doesn't talk about, you know, hospital avoidance, it doesn't talk about early discharge, it doesn't talk about efficiencies that we can achieve, you know, looking after patients and therefore, you know, getting funding out of the hospital system into general practice. If you have a look at the detail, it really is about capitation payments for chronic medical conditions, not more, not less. So, you know, I'm sort of wondering, is that really, you know, the medical home still, or is it something completely different? So my concern is, has it become a branding exercise? And the way I look at it now is, you know, it's a capitation payment for chronic medical condition, not more, not less. So again, it has nothing to do with the medical home concept the RACGP proposed. You know, it's something that's been developed by the primary healthcare advisory groups and then those implementation groups the Department of Health have set up.
What did you make of the department releasing all those details late last Friday, including the somewhat controversial suggestion that there would be a five-visit cap? which they've immediately backflipped on over the weekend. What do you make of all of that? Did they release things too soon? Did they not consult? Did they get scared?
I was disappointed, and I've been, you know, quite public on that. It's about healthcare, so the information has to be transparent and accurate. Healthcare is not meant to be a political sandpit where you can just play around and see what happens. You know, that's not what our patients deserve, and it's certainly not what practitioners deserve either. So I was informed by the media that the release was coming out at 4 o'clock, and I said, oh, that's interesting, I need to have a look myself. You know, the journalist asked me, what do you make of it? And so I literally looked at it online and said, look, you know, one of the things I see now is there's now a capitation not even on chronic disease management, but also on acute visits too, which I couldn't see that was making any sense at all. And it came up, you know, the capitation on those 5 visits was in other documents there as well. And I thought, that's really my immediate concern. What the hell are they doing? And again, that's why we quite strongly came out and said, look, it doesn't make any sense. It's actually going to harm our patients. And not only that, it's also going to harm the health system and the taxpayer, because, you know, patients don't become acutely unwell because they have nothing else to do. And they don't plan to become acutely unwell. So if you're unwell and then can't afford to see your GP because it's the sixth time you've been unwell in the last 12 months, you will be calling the ambulance out, and the cost to the taxpayer is $800 per call out, or you will be presenting to a public emergency department, and the cost for presentation there is at least $200 to the taxpayer as well. So again, that didn't make any sense. So and then Monday morning, I think all of a sudden the document then changed. And again, that was certainly the right move. Again, in order for it to be transparent and accurate, it would have been nice to say, look, it's now a version 2.0 that's online. And it would have been nice to be informed of the change as well. Look, the RACGP is going to put a paper out to our members explaining what the healthcare homes is actually involving based on the information that we have. And I think members and GPs have to make up their mind whether they're going to sign up with, you know, that program or not. Again, you know, it sounds like a capitation payment system to me. I don't see anything of benefit to our patients, and currently, personally, I can see little benefit to practitioners as well.
A couple of GPs I know have mentioned that this feels like it's been touted as a trial, 200 practices, and yet it feels like it's the beginning of a rollout. What's your sense of that?
So we've always supported a trial, you know, for academic reasons only, you know. And if you're on a trial, you design it properly, you fund it properly, you know, you have your study group, you have your control group, you have an ethics committee, you have a safety net for participants who may drop out of the trial as well. You know, that's the way to do. So if you want to do a trial according to scientific academic standards, you know, it's very clear cut, you know, how you're actually going to do this. Now, the way healthcare homes is now, you don't hear trial anymore. If you had a look through the documents, you never see the word trial in the documents. It's implementation phase one. So it's very clear. And looking through the documents again, it's very clear that trial is going to work, you know, no matter what. Rather than saying, okay, let's test it, see what the outcomes are. And the outcomes of the trial are hopefully informing further policy developments. That's how you are designing evidence-based healthcare policies. So you run a trial first, you are testing your assumptions, and you move on from there. And that probably would be the academically and scientifically appropriate way to do. Look, I'm hoping and I'm confident that the government and the Department of Health are changing it accordingly. It can't be in their interest to design health policy on the run. It can only be in the interest of the department and the minister to produce evidence-based health policies, because they are the ones who stand the test of time, they are the ones who improve outcomes for our patients, and they are the policies that inspire confidence in practitioners as well. Yeah. And that's really quite important these days.
That runs into a question that a GP asked me to ask you. Yeah. And I might quote it because she put it quite well. How are you going to maintain a positive public profile for general practice, given the very negative government stance about GPs currently? The atmosphere in GP land feels pretty negative right now, and there is no public recognition of good quality primary care. We feel deserted by the current government, who, despite the rhetoric of we are listening, it's just not the case.
Yeah, I share the sentiment. It's disappointing. You know, yeah. I'm a practicing GP in Huonville in Tasmania. It's mm-hmm. a socially disadvantaged area south of Hobart. And they are the same concerns my patients tell me. It doesn't sound like general practice being valued, and we are constantly being portrayed as the problem. Whereas the evidence is very clear, we're actually the solution of the problems we have in our healthcare system. Where the main cost drivers are, whether we like it or not, the hospital system. And we need to have a look of how we are getting the money from the hospitals being wasted back into general practice, where we know we are efficient. Now, it's not the role of the RACGP as an academic college to get involved in political argy-bargy. We are politically agnostic. We don't have a political message. And it's not my interest to make the RACGP a political organization. It's our role to provide the best evidence that hopefully is going to inform evidence-based health policy. That's our role. So it's my role as RACGP president to advise the government accordingly when we are supporting policy initiatives and when we disagree on policy initiatives. When we disagree on policy initiatives, and quite frankly, we've done this now for quite some time, I'm going to give reasons why that is. And whether the government listens or not, that's really not up to me. You know, that's a political choice. And government has to take political responsibility for that as well. The difficulty is in health policy is that if you have failed health policy, it's going to harm patients. So patients who can't access their GP and they're unwell and they're delaying a presentation because they can't afford it, they're doing harm to themselves. How do you justify that? And you could argue, you know, GPs are making a lot of money and they're always complaining, but the evidence yet again doesn't support it. So if you have a look at the Australian Taxation Office in terms of, you know, average income per year, you realize that the average income per year of a GP is now less than half of what a hospital specialist would earn. Now, that's not really that important because, you know, we knew this beforehand. So I'm not a GP in Huonville because I'm in it for the money. I'm in it because the GP, the community deserves to have a GP. I think it's a common sense approach. But, you know, having a Medicare rebate freeze over years, having it extended, having zero support in any other ways, and then being targeted in the media as cost drivers, you know, talk about, you know, bulk billing and incomes and so forth. I understand the GPs are disappointed. Now, again, the federal government hardly spends anything on general practice. So, you know, if we include primary health networks even for the general practice funding, it's $7.1 billion every year. If you take this out just for Medicare funding, including practice incentive payments, it's $6.5 billion every year. And people think, oh, that's a fair bit. Now we have 24 million people in Australia. 86% of the population sees their GP at least once a year. So the cost of Medicare in general practice per person per month is $28.20. So that's less than a subscription to Foxtel. And that figure has been steady over the last 10 years, hasn't changed. So never mind whether people say, oh, people see their GP more often, you know, never mind, you know, what else is going on. Well, the cost is the same for the government, so it doesn't really matter, you know, whether somebody sees the GP twice a day or 10 times a day, as long as on average in Australia for 24 million people, the cost is $28.20 per person per month. What does it really matter? And it's got to be understood. On this, so as I said, you know, federal government spends $6.5 billion on general practice. If we look at how much the federal government spends, for example, on the subsidy for private health insurers, that is $6.1 billion. So it's pretty much the same amount. Yeah. Private health insurance only available to less than 50% of the population. So why not funding Medicare for general practice? That would affect, you know, over 86% of the population every year, rather than putting this to private health insurers. Now, not only are they paying $6.1 billion a subsidy, that subsidy is also indexed over the next 4 years. And it's indexed not at CPI, it's indexed at 4%. And that doesn't make any sense. So on the one hand, you appreciate, you know, there's a subsidy for private health insurer and you index that. But when there's a subsidy for people who want to see their GP, that's called Medicare, you're not going to index that. So for private health insurers, you're indexed at 4%. Why not saying index at 2%, you know, which is CPI. So you have 2% spare. Now, the spare money you have, it's $180 million every year. Why don't put this then to lift the index freeze for general practice, which would be exactly the same amount? So it wouldn't cost any money. It would just shift the funds that are available now and budgeted now from an area that's available only to a few people to an area that's available to each and every Australian. So that's the sort of advice we have been giving the health minister, her advisors, the department, and the prime minister even. Well, you know the outcome so far, nothing has happened. Now, again, what I'm not making up this stuff, you know, that's out there now. The data is out there now. And by all means, you know, have a look at the budget papers from May and have a look at the final budget outcome statement. So the money is there, the data is there. Let's have a common sense approach when it comes to health policy for general practice. And let's implement those policies. And if you don't, then you're doing it for political reasons. And look, you know, there's nothing I can do about. You know, that's something I can comment on. But again, that's the role of the RSVGP now. Continue to inform on best practice, continue to inform on best health policies. But that's, of course, just a sideshow, because the main thing for us is, you know, standards and education for GPs,
exactly,
which is still the main domain.
Which brings us to the CPD reforms that came in, or that were ratified in at the October conference.
Yes.
There seems to be a lot of confusion about a couple of the reforms, and it seems to be conflating two issues. One is planning, learning and need, which is the mandatory component, 40 points of the 130 points.
Yes, I put it in perspective probably.
Sure.
So again, every triennium or before each and every triennium or way before each and every triennium, we are looking at how we can improve our CPD program. And plan is nothing else but a reflective quality improvement component or quality improvement exercise. And the evidence behind it is that if we focus on reflection as practitioners, we actually do improve outcomes for our patients and we just become better doctors on the way. I think that's quite nice. So I think that's a win-win. So that's not new. Again, plenty of evidence out there. And the RACGP tried to introduce reflective learning plans really seven years ago. And we had a paper-based approach first. And that didn't really quite work out for many, many reasons, because nobody wants to use paper. And in particular, over triennium, you're losing that. Nobody keeps it over 3 years' time, you know, and it was really quite difficult to do. So we dropped it, and again, we reconsidered using it, and we said, look, you know, the moment we have a better online environment and better IT, it's something we need to consider again. So it's always been on our mind for obvious reasons. So again, it's nothing new there, and again, you know, the evidence backs it up. Come revalidation, and there was this interim report on revalidation published out of nowhere on the 16th of August, I believe, this year it was, with a component that colleges are meant to strengthen their CPD programs. And one of the major components was a reflective tool. The second aspect was also identification of poor performing doctors early on.
Yes.
And that's a completely separate issue. So when the medical board report came out, with a strong emphasis on reflection as part of CPD, we actually had to decide, with our new triennium coming up, are we going to introduce it now, which is January, very short time frame? Are we introducing within the triennium as an option, or are we introducing that for 2019, 2020? There are the three scenarios we had, and there were pros and cons. Now, the medical board then says, okay, you know, we published the report in August 2016. We are focusing on reflection and enhanced CPD. We are consulting with the profession. In 2017, we are starting pilots.
Right.
We want to know how you do it. So we as an academic medical college decided, okay, if we want to shape revalidation, if we want to get ready for our members to make sure that if you are signing up with the RACGP CPD program, you are covered and you are actually in line with what the medical board is going to tell you to do no matter what, we probably don't have any other choice but to get started in January. Because if we were starting in January now, and make it compulsory rather than optional, we can demonstrate with the medical board really quickly, if they want it,
yes,
you know, how reflective learning has made a difference. Now, I've no doubt it's going to make a difference. The evidence is too overwhelming based on international experiences there. But for members, it's going to be important, because if the medical board calls you and says, can you demonstrate how your enhanced CPD worked for you, the member has to say, okay, that's what I did, that's how it worked for me, and here's my reflective exercise. And RACGP members and RACGP CPD participants will be able to do this. So again, that's why it's an evidence-based part of our CPD program. I'm absolutely confident it's going to meet the requirement of the medical boards. And that's the feedback we've received from the medical board so far when we talked about, you know, plan. Now, you could argue, oh, that's a lot of points that are being taken away, and why do you allocate 40 points there? And look, to be honest, I think it's not a discussion. You know that if you are an RACGP member or RACGP CPD participant, we are asking 430 points. Plan would allocate for 40 points. Now, the number of points isn't capped, of course. So you can
do 270 points.
As many numbers. And yep. It's interesting that you make, that you say 207 points, because 270 points, because that is exactly the average amount of points of over 26,000 CPD and RACGP members. And so you say, what about category one? Well, the average points for category one are 170. So, it's not capped. You can do more.
Yes.
Pretty much all GPs are doing far more. And so again, it's a non-issue. Again, yes, it's 40 points. It's one category. It's compulsory to do. You still have to do one category one. You still have to do your CPR as well. But again, it's not an issue. Now, looking at the report from the medical board that was published 2 days ago about when they surveyed over 1,000 doctors and say, well, what sort of CPD are you doing? And how do you feel about self-assessment? How do you feel about reflective learning? Well, it was over 93% of doctors surveyed say, yes, we strongly support reflective learning. Over 92%, I believe, of doctors said, yes, we strongly support self-assessment. So look, we are very much in line of what doctors think. And that's, again, I think it's just a common sense approach.
The other issue is the cost increase to accredited learning providers.
So what we introduced was a upload fee of CPD points, which is a very controversial $2, which hardly ever matters. Really doesn't matter to the vast majority of providers. We've advised each and every provider now in writing, based on the activities they did over the last year, how much more, how much less they would have to pay. And got quite a few letters of organizations who were concerned. And when we sent the letter back that they have to probably pay $60 in total per year extra on top, they said, no, that's actually fine. We weren't aware. But let's go to the core of it. It would be nice if we didn't have to pay anything for accreditation. It would be really good, wouldn't it? It'd be really good if educational providers would do the right thing, would demonstrate the evidence how their education is enhancing the learning of the participant. And it would be really good if education providers would also upload the points. The difficulty is it doesn't really work that way. So what we are hearing from members, again, is they are going on courses, they are doing everything they're being asked for, and the points aren't uploaded. So, of course, members are going to call the RACGP and say, how come the points aren't uploaded? So we need to then go back to the provider and say, can you please upload the points? And they say, yes, we do it. And then a week later, it's still not being done. So it's an administrative nightmare. And that's got to stop, quite frankly. And that's just inappropriate. And it doesn't work for our members. And it doesn't work for us as an organization. But it's not our role to chase up, points all the time, because there is a cost. So we are trying as much as possible as compensating for that. And again, we had very different proposals put to council with regards to how much more we'd have to change. And we just have to make it work now with the $2. It wasn't the original figure. It was actually much, much higher, which we thought, we can't actually get through. But again, that has to happen now. It's not a money-making exercise. CPD within the RACGP is run cost neutral. That's the bottom line there. And it's not in our interest, to make any money there, because it's really a membership-based organization. We do what our members really want us to do. But it's got to work. Accreditation costs, had to increase according to CPI, because actually a fair bit of work now to accredit educational providers as well, in particular in line now of what the medical board is going to tell us. So it's going to be far more work. You know, again, there are education providers out there who are providing education that probably doesn't meet the cut. You know, let's face it, you know that as much as I do. So again, we want GPs to visit educational events that do make a difference to their learning and their practice, because that's what the medical board is going to ask us to do. If GPs want to go out there to events because they just enjoy it for whatever reason, that is fine, of course, as well. But again, that's not the main motivation or rationale why you are attending, you know, educational courses and events. So we've got to be very clear. So that may not suit everybody. And again, that's fair enough. Again, if you have a look at the medical board reports again, you know, 4% of all surveyed doctors say they don't need any education. They're absolutely fine, you know, they don't need any CPD, and that's all good. Now, if you say the number's even less, it's only 3%, you know, if you put this 3% of RECGP members, there will be 1,000 members. I haven't received 1,000 complaints, I've received a handful.
Yeah.
And, you know, after I've explained the rationale as I do to you now, people say, no, look, that's actually fine. What I'm concerned about is that there are a lot of people out there being quite publicly against, you know, RECGP movement, been very public, and privately they are supporting what we're doing. So again, that's if you are in for headline grabbing, that's lovely, but you know, again, you're doing it for the wrong reason. So yep. It's not in my interest, not in the RECGP interest, to fob anybody off. We need to do the right thing by our members. We have to do the right thing by the Australian Medical Council, and we have to do the right thing by the medical board. And if they want us to enhance the CPD experience, if they want to introduce reflective learning, if that's what the majority of members want anyway, then what are we waiting for? What we needed to achieve was to get the IT environment right. The content is being developed. The IT experience is still being worked on now. I have no doubt we are running on time. So, you know, come January, we'll be ready to go.
Let's look a little more broadly. We're on the brink of a new triennium. Where would you like to see general practice primary care in 3 years' time? What would, if you could wave a magic wand right now and take us to the end of 2019,
yes.
What would you like to have seen improved, both for doctors and for patients?
So for general practice has to be the solution to the problems we have in our healthcare system, because it is. It's just not being perceived as a solution. In order for that behavior to change and for the perception to change, we just need to educate the public better. And that's what we've been doing as the RACGP with our brand awareness campaign,
mm-hmm.
which we know has been very effective amongst the public. And we need to be closer to political decision makers. So whenever it comes to health policy discussions in respective party rooms, I want politicians to be informed, not by lobby groups that are in for a financial interest no matter what. But I want them to be informed so the electorate feels the politicians are looking after them when it comes to health. Because if your voters aren't healthy, there's not much point talking about employment opportunities and so forth, education opportunities, because they won't be able to attend either of them. So health comes first, and we need to prioritize that. So within the health spectrum, general practice, of course, should be left and right and center, because that's where we are. That also is some education for other professionals within the health spectrum. And, you know, I appreciate my hospital specialists and pharmacists and allied health practitioners. But again, we have to stand our ground. That's what our members expect. And quite frankly, that's what our patients expect us to.
Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.